Party. My name's Kieran, I'll be chairing the meeting. Anthony is a guest speaker who's come to speak on fracking and the environment. So the format of the meetings are that Anthony will speak for usually 15, 20 minutes, I'd guess, roughly about. Then we'll have contributions, questions, discussion from everyone else. Anthony will come back in and respond to anything that's been raised, and then we'll move on to some discussion about things that are happening locally that we're involved with. Right, so, Anthony, take it away.
Yeah. Well, I noticed on Facebook last night that apparently fracking is going to take place over in the Peak District on a team which is going to spread all the way to the west as far as Nottinghamshire, so presumably that means they're going to be fracking underneath Derby from that site. Now, fracking's been in the news quite a bit of late. I mean, there's been, on a positive level, four protesters against fracking in the West Sussex village of Balcombe, including Green MEP Caroline Lucas, who were all recently acquitted of charges relating to their arrests on anti-fracking demos. There's also a big anti-fracking camp at Barton Moss up in Eccles near Manchester. Now, protesters there have been blocking lorries bringing equipment on site since the 27th of November last year. There's been numerous arrests by the Greater Manchester Police, including one of a 15-year-old school student. Most of the arrests have been for walking slowly in front of lorries, which is a tactic which was also used to good effect by the Hovis strikers last year, and hopefully it'll be just as successful for the anti-fracking movement. And as well as that, there's been large demos in Manchester against the fracking, mobilising over 10,000 people. On a more negative side, we've seen the government's tax breaks for fracking. Now, according to Socialist Worker from July last year, fracking firms will pay just 30% tax on future shale production, which is less than half the 62% for new North Sea oil fields, which was already a discount from the original 81%. I understand since then the government have been wanting to give more and more tax breaks for fracking. And what's more, the government is planning to change the trespass law to enable fracking companies to drill under people's homes without trespassing, presumably to cover a loophole which anti-frackers thought they might have been able to use to stop fracking. You have to bear in mind, though, the last time the government changed the trespass law, it wasn't to make it easier to trespass, it was to make it harder to trespass. It was to criminalise trespassing, not only by protesters, but by homeless squatters, which led to the spectacle of homeless people dying because they've been sleeping outside when there's been a vacant property nearby. So this latest move by the Tories is a naked example of how the Tories love having one rule for rich and one rule for poor. So what is fracking then? Well, apart from a swear word on another planet in Battlestar Galactica, by the end of this meeting I think you'll all agree with me that fracking should be a swear word on this planet as well. In the words of Socialist Worker from August last year, fracking is a technique to extract gas and oil locked in shale rocks by blasting them with a mixture of water, sand and chemicals and fracturing the rocks. Fracking can also be used to blast methane gas out of coal seams if they are too deep to mine. So that's what fracking is, but why is everybody suddenly, why are the establishment rather suddenly rushing to do fracking? Well, there's profits to be made basically, especially as a result of new technology has probably been one of the big things, because although the fracking technique was invented in the 1950s, its use has been boosted by new technology that allows horizontal drilling. There's the government tax breaks, which I've already mentioned, and the, as the socialist worker points out, Osborne's generosity may have something to do with people like Lord Brown, who is both a director of Crodrilla, one of the big companies involved in fracking, and an advisor to the Cabinet Office, or Guy Robinson, a senior aide to Tory Environment Secretary Owen Paterson, who previously worked for the lobby firm run by David Cameron's advisor Linton Crosby. Its clients included fracking lobbyists in Australia. A third thing is the fact that we're now in the what's termed peak oil, in that the oil production worldwide has reached a peak, and the remaining oil's now slowly becoming harder and more costly to extract from the ground. In the UK in particular, North Sea oil peaked back in the 1980s, so the search is on for alternative sources of energy, and the establishment seem to prefer fracking. And there's the so-called energy gap in the electricity generation. I mean, we've seen scare stories for the past few years of how electricity use would exceed supply, and horror stories about the lights going out during the 2012 Olympics. Now, that didn't happen, but it's not stopped the scare stories continuing. And what is a fact is that gas power stations can be constructed and brought into use rapidly. And then there's the thing about energy security. Now, most of the oil we get is from the Middle East, countries like Iraq. In the Middle East, a lot of the regimes are hostile to the West. I wonder why. Now, Western imperialism did suffer rather a bloody nose there over not just Iraq but Afghanistan as well. So I think they're looking towards fracking to try to reduce the reliance on oil from the Middle East. And there's also gas from, largely we're getting gas from Russia. Now, politicians in Europe, this is from Socialist Worker last year, jittery about their dependence on Russian gas pipelines, see fracking as an alternative. Now, I bet that's even more the case now with the troubles going on in Ukraine at the moment. So, is fracking the answer? Well, let's look at some of the dangers of fracking. I mean, there's earthquakes. Mm-hmm. According to Socialist Worker August last year, fracking by Quadrilla Resources has caused earthquakes in Blackpool. Quadrilla's own report found the quakes were caused when fracking fluid blasted into a previously unknown fault line underground. Now, how many more previously unknown fault lines are there? There's pollution of the water supplies. Cancer-causing chemicals can leak into drinking water. A study of the Tara gas fields in Australia found that 44% of the wells leaked methane gas as well. And there's been videos knocking around YouTube which show people being able to physically light tap water as it comes out of their taps. And some of Quadrilla's fracking plans, such as in Balcombe at Sussex, are within much less than 2,000 feet of groundwater. And what's more, I've mentioned the risk of methane. Now, some leaks in Australia were at dangerous levels, and one was at levels high enough to explode. Yet Dart Energy, which I believe is the company behind the plans to frack over in Peak District, is now using this technology in Aberdeen. And the fact that fracking is so greedy for water as well means that it's going to cause water shortages, even ignoring the pollution. Studies in Australia have found that fracking operations can cause groundwater levels to drop by as much as 15 metres. And last but certainly not least, fracking will lead to the continuing reliance on fossil fuels which produce greenhouse gases and indeed promotes the use of greenhouse fossil fuels rather. Despite the spurious claims by the Tories that fracking is in some way green and that burning shale gas will emit less carbon than alternatives, the fact remains burning gas from fracking creates carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas, and the methane released by fracking is an even more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2. So, what's wrong with the global warming? Is global warming still really a problem? Well, yes. Climate change is already having an impact. Unless we do something to stop it, the worst is yet to come, scientists have warned. Even a temperature rise globally of 2 degrees centigrade would cause substantial problems for humanity, let alone wildlife. Yet the capitalist society is going, the way capitalist society is going, virtually all forecasts of the global warming to well exceed even this, with potentially disastrous results, such as greater and fiercer storms. In the UK, we saw the massive floods this winter, especially in Somerset levels, with people flooded out of their homes over Christmas. We saw hurricane force winds, especially in southwest, with the Dawlish railway line bridge washed away by the sea. Now, is this really caused by global warming? Well, I think it's rather more likely to be caused by global warming than by gay marriage, but that's another story. If you think we've got problems, then around the world, hurricanes are definitely getting worse in recent years. We saw Katrina, which devastated New Orleans not 10 years ago, and Superstorm Sandy, which caused massive problems in New York. Mm. Poor countries are even worse affected. Look at how Typhoon Haiyan totally devastated the Philippines, killing many thousands of people. And Bangladesh, partly because it's so poor and partly because it's low-lying flat land, is regularly hit by increasingly severe tropical cyclones, which often cause hundreds of thousands of deaths there. And at the other extreme, where we don't get storms, we're going to have droughts, which are going to lead to famine. I mean, we've already seen the famines in Africa. It's going to lead to wildfires, which we've seen an increasing prevalence of in the US and in Australia. And the increasing risk of dust storms. I remember a couple of years ago at Marxism learning about the infamous dust storms in the Midwest US back in the 1930s Dust Bowl, and the increase in droughts due to global warming is likely to make those ever more likely. And the droughts may severely impact on the ability to grow enough food to feed the world. Contrary to popular myth, there is enough food now to feed the world. The famines which exist now are a distribution of food problem, not a supply problem. But if global warming increases, we may well end up not physically being able to grow enough food to feed the world. From Socialist Worker of April this year, wheat, maize and stocks are all expected to plummet. By the year 2100, heat and humidity could compromise normal human activities, including growing food or working outdoors in some areas for parts of the year. Scary. And then there's the rising sea level. Now, as well as that aggravating the effects of the storms, as storm surges affect a far wider area, some countries, such as Maldives and Tuvalu, could end up underwater, leaving entire populations stateless. Large swathes of Bangladesh could be submerged, and the UK is not immune. I mean, look at Lincolnshire, how that's going to be affected if the sea level rises, and Already we've seen the RSPB forced to allow partial flooding by the sea of the Titchwell Nature Reserve in Norfolk due to rising sea levels. So what can we do about it? Well, there are real alternatives which can not only combat climate change but can combat the energy crisis as well. Now, nuclear is certainly not one of them. I mean, the Fukushima disaster in March 2011, when the Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan was hit by a tsunami following an earthquake, led to massive pollution, which has spread, massive nuclear radioactive pollution rather, which has spread thousands of miles into the Pacific. Now, we don't tend to hear about that, but it's definitely out there, and massive pollution within, massive radiation rather, within Japan itself, and this is going to lead to cancers and birth defects, and the radiation can linger for tens of thousands of years. And here in the UK, we've got pollution in the Irish Sea and North Wales from Sellafield. And much as the establishment like to make us believe that the radioactivity from nuclear power stations is only slightly above background level, what they don't tell us is that it is more dangerous due to the decay of uranium, which means that cells which are irradiated are then irradiated again just as they're about to divide, which causes cancers to be far more likely. So what is the answer? Well, the short answer is wind turbines, both onshore and offshore, which now the government is making wind generation harder at the same time as it's promoting fracking. They've already said that there's going to be no new subsidies for wind farms, which haven't already had approval. And the Prime Minister was considering introducing new controls on onshore generation in the next election manifesto, such as a cap, further cuts to subsidies, more planning restrictions or limits on noise from turbines. Not that there really is a lot of noise from turbines, but they like to make out there is. And a Conservative source has indicated that Cameron is of one mind with some of the loudest proponents of onshore wind farms and wants to go further in cutting government support for them. As for UKIP, well, they're even more anti-wind energy. Now, opponents of wind farms point out that wind turbines can only produce energy if the wind is blowing. True, but what they don't point out is that the UK has what's been called the best wind in Europe, which means that there's enough wind blowing somewhere in the UK to supply our energy needs over 95% of the time. And other forms of renewable energy include tidal energy. Now, I'd say that tidal barrages could probably help to reduce coastal erosion over in East Anglia, as well as producing energy. There's solar energy, and rather a Cinderella in the UK, but it is definitely viable is geothermal energy, i.e. Drilling into the ground, possibly using technology similar to fracking, but instead of causing pollution, it instead just pumps down water and heat comes up as a result of the higher temperature of the earth as you get deeper. Besides, not as much energy would be needed if we employ energy conservation. Every home should be insulated. There should be regulations to make sure every new home has adequate insulation. There should be regulations on the business and on building to make sure that energy efficient methods are used. And last but not least, we should be moving away from private cars and moving towards the use of public transport, which would heavily reduce energy, which would heavily reduce not just the use of energy, but the use of the emission of CO2 as well, and also moving away from aircraft, which emit a hell of a lot of greenhouse gases, towards high speed rail or what have you. So there you have it.
Thanks very much for that. That's really brilliantly summed up, I thought. Okay, right. So if you want to speak, just nod or wink or raise your hand and I'll just make a note. Okay, Dick first, then Becky.
Hey, a couple of things. One thing is always a massive conspiracy of silence on that. I know, and that is obviously coal, you know. Obviously, thanks to the Thatcher government, well done, Margaret Thatcher, in basically corporate vandalising the coal industry. We're also in the process of now having to import coal from Russia and so on. Obviously, so if you actually went in that direction, there's obviously ecological aspects which you have to actually deal with. But it is a source of energy, which is only dumped basically because North Sea oil is in the 80s, this country was awash with North Sea oil. So, and those coal mines that weren't economically viable at the time, The only other thing is regards, when you had the floods last year, you had these Dutch firms which were had these pumps and brought those to the deal with the floods in Somerset. Well, Holland is one of the more vulnerable countries in terms of flooding.
I know that I'm Dutch and I've actually experienced flooding in my hometown, so I know all about it.
So if they're able to deal with that effectively, it does rather show this country's administration pretty poor order. Mm-hmm. With regards to the other thing about tidal thing, it's the tidal energy. Well, the Seven Bore is an obvious one as well.
Okay, thanks very much, Dick. Becky next and then Susan again.
I just wanted to thank Anthony, first of all, for the talk, because I, for my shame, haven't actually been looking into fracking as much as I should have been and didn't know as much of it about it as I should. But I think what your talk really did was perfectly sum up why the free market argument that the market creates the system that best suits people and that people need and want is such a lie and such a myth, because what you've illustrated perfectly for us is the argument of socialism, that actually the desire, the need to constantly find new ways to invest money to pull out more profit for themselves creates inefficient policies, hence why we have 300 years worth of coal still under the ground, but we're not using it, but we're doing something even more damaging than coal uses, and creating the myth of the ugliness of the wind turbines to try and frighten anyone away from anything that's efficient, and ignoring the fact that they're beautiful and elegant and we should have more of them.
Thanks very much, Sue and Martin.
Yeah, I know nothing really about the science of fracking other than what I've learned from some, you know, going to a few meetings. But I think one thing that always stops me and makes me think is, right, the questions I would like to ask about fracking are, who's in control of it? Mm. Who's done the research? Are the people that have done the research the same as the people that are in control of the fracking firms? Is there any independent research? Who's that being done by? Who's funded that? Who benefits from fracking? Is it actually us? Cheap gas? Is that really a benefit? How long does it last for? What are the alternatives? Does the concentration on gas stop us actually investing in, you know, in investigating more around renewables? What about wave power? What about wind power? What about solar power? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think if we can't actually answer those questions, or if the answers to those questions are suspect, which I think they are, mm-hmm.
yeah.
then I think we should say we've got huge alarm bells running, mm-hmm. because we know that those with money like to invest in things which are going to make them lots and lots more money. And it seems to me that the concentration on this whole thing about, you know, fracking's the best thing since sliced bread, it's going to create all this huge amounts of cheap gas, everybody's going to be better off, our energy bills are going to come down.
Yes.
I don't think they are. Something tells me our energy bills are not going to come down if we get our gas from fracking. Mm-hmm. Strikes me that our energy bills are going to stay the same because the interests of the energy companies will keep them high. So that's the sort of my sort of thinking, even before I start looking at the science of the whole thing. And then when you do start looking at the science of it, it's really scary. You know? I mean, what are we doing? Pumping chemicals into the ground in order to actually fracture it, in order to allow methane into the atmosphere, when we know that methane is one of the major greenhouse gases, incredibly dangerous. You know, we've got enough methane from cow farts, we don't need any more coming up out of the ground. So I think start from who economically benefits and why is fracking suddenly being posed as an alternative, what's going on there. Then look at the science of it all, and then work out whether, you know, we actually should be arguing much more strongly for alternatives.
Thanks very much, Sue. Before Martin comes in, I'm going to briefly abuse my position as chair, because I will be brief.
Before you abuse your position in the chair. Why don't you?
Yes,
I'm a university geology and geography student.
Keep us quiet from now on.
I completely agree with you, actually. I've become a bit discontinuous with geology and the whole fracking thing as well. I don't know if anyone attended the fracking talk at Derby University, but it was really interesting to hear from the Quadrilla side, but also the people who are against it. And one thing that I actually got was completely what you said as well. Who actually gets it? Well, Total, who are a French company, the French have banned fracking, coincidentally, they will be investing in, they've invested with Quadrilla for the sites, Blackpool, around about there as well. And there's laws that are changing so that they would actually get the money. So it would be the French government benefiting, not us. And I do agree with the pollution side as well. I see the geology behind it, but I also see the geography and the human side as well. And it's a very dangerous concept to say, well, we need the energy, we need the gas, because all the north oil fields and all of that are running out, but we need to sustain ourselves as well, and we need to protect our society too and our wildlife ecology, because we need to keep it for future generations, also for future geologists as well as geographers. So, yeah, it's very controversial, my two parts of my degree, and not everyone agrees with me, or the geologists don't, because I'm involved with also the applied petroleum side of it as well. And it's they don't agree with everything I say, but, yeah.
Keep saying it.
I try, but, yeah, that's where I've had the controversies. But I also understand the science behind fracking as well. And basically, you're fracturing rock, and there's millions of faults in the ground. That's because as we have exhumation, it passes through what's called the brittle ductile transition zone. So there will be lots of fracturing. And as you fracture rock, as you go further down, you do have the potential to contaminate what's also the geology underground, but also the reservoirs for water. And water is actually the most important resource from a rock's underground. We need a fresh water supply. That's the most important, before petroleum or gas or whatever. And yeah, I hope it can help answer a couple of what you've said. I've been itching to say when you were talking, but yeah. And also what you mentioned about food security, completely true as well. I'm going to be doing my research project on soil science in the Mediterranean, which has been affected a lot by global warming. It's known as the major hotspot. And I'll be looking at vineyard soils and how pollution affects that, and affects the security of future food as well, because you have global flash flooding in the area too. So. Yeah, I hope
it'll be interesting research.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Thanks very much. That's really unexpectedly expert. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening.
Have you abused your position as chair while watching?
No, he hasn't yet. Thanks,
Martin.
I stopped him. Now he can do it.
I was simply going to make a comment about this, but we've been here before when it comes to new energy technologies, because this is when nuclear was first introduced, one of the things we were promised was electricity too cheap to meter.
Yeah.
And of course, with that's turned out to be massively disingenuous. And I think that what's interesting, I think, is that people are less willing to buy it this time round with fracking.
Mm.
I think you're seeing a lot more organised opposition to it before it's really gotten underway. Anyway, that's all I was going to say. Martin's next, and then Nick.
I'm going back to what seemed to me to be, I don't know if I was mistaken, a plea for the reintroduction of coal, remining of coal. well, you know, we're faced with global warming. Coal is captured carbon. If you burn it, you're going to put masses of carbon dioxide in the air. It's not the answer.
Unless it's an alternative, it can be treated, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
on
carbon,
its own, it wouldn't, no.
It's never, it has never been shown that carbon capture works effectively or is a cheap or economically viable system of using coal. Now, that is obviously because there are vested interests involved, but until you get that kind of experimentation, it seems very dangerous to dig up coal and then burn it. A couple of other things. You talked about water shortage. It was ironic that one of the countries which is fracking like mad is Australia, which every year you hear, I mean, they have their showers are rationed to certain periods in the day because they have so little water, and yet they're introducing and exploiting the methodology which affects the water levels. The other thing that is also worrying, I mean, water levels are very worrying because you get predictions that the next set of war will not be about oil, not about anything like that. There will be about water shortage. People will fight to get water. And there have been examples of, I can't remember, was it Somalia where there were the shortage of water and you had the fights between herdsmen and settled farmers, and that was to do with water shortages. So that is already happening. And the other thing that is very worrying is that the warmer the climate gets, you have things like mosquitoes which carry malaria, which are adapting to the warming climate, but are no longer, or we are no longer able to effectively eradicate those mosquitoes because they are resistant to the various insecticides which deal with them. So they think another factor in the coming of global warming will be an increase in the spread of diseases.
Very sobering thought. Thank you very much, Martin. Nicola?
When I first heard the term fracking a couple of years ago, and when I heard that it might cause an earthquake, to me I was like, well, that's it then, isn't it? Nobody's going to bother, because why would anybody, any area that's inhabited, you know, why would you even do that? Why would you even risk having an earthquake? That was my very first thought. And then the other thing I want to say is, I mean, I'm a very simple person, right? We now have the technology, so why don't we just have solar power in the Mediterranean where it's hot, and wind power and sea power in our country where it rains and it's very windy and we have a lot of big waves. I mean, why don't we just do that? As you said, we've got enough wind power, you know, to do that, and there's enough sunshine.
That's another thing about that is called geoengineering. It's where, you can use the resources like of climate to actually produce power and electricity, so they are starting to think like that.
On the earthquakes, as I just said earlier, I'm Dutch, and so I can use the Netherlands as an example where fracking has been on the day for years, and in the northeast of the country, province of Groningen, they've been doing that for years, and the earthquakes measured there have gone up a lot, and in certain areas houses are already being affected. It's by far the poorest part of the country, and by far the highest unemployment, so and that And that's why the government keeps selling it, like, look, we create jobs in this area. But even the most fanatic pro-fracking professors at Dutch universities have slammed the Dutch government for actually not doing research, proper research before starting it. So if even the biggest advocates of fracking already say that, that says enough, really. Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much. Martin has already indicated that lots of hands going up.
Just the thing about fracking is it produces fossil fuels. Now we know, that gas is a better way of producing electricity than oil or coal because it puts less carbon dioxide in the air. But we know that even the amounts of carbon dioxide that gas produces is too much to avoid climate change. We cannot avoid climate change using any form of fossil fuels to produce the electricity. You just can't do it. You really need to change the whole way we produce electricity. We have to produce it in a way that does not produce carbon dioxide. But the problem with all these methods is it's not the actual production of electricity, it's the storage of electricity. There is no way of storing electricity. So if you can produce masses of electricity at 8 o'clock at night, that's great. But if you can only produce it at 12 o'clock in the day when the demand for electricity goes down, you have problems. Now the answer to that is a change in the way electricity is distributed and a change in the cables. You need to go to direct current rather than alternating current. You need high density cables, etc. And if you had those things, it's much cheaper to transport electricity using these cables. You don't have the loss that the old methods have. You lose quite a lot of electricity as it's transmitted across large distances. And you could actually have electricity from Spain transmitted to use in Britain. And the advantage of solar energy in Spain and the sort of experiments they do is that they heat up water and they pump the water up to the top of a tower, and they have an ordinary turbine in the tower to produce electricity, and then when the electricity is needed they use that water that's up there already from when there is actually bright sunshine to put it there in order to produce the electricity when it's needed. Now, there have been experiments in Wales when they've done it with reservoirs. They pump water up into the reservoirs and then dropped it through the dams at the point when the actual demand for electricity exists. But obviously the problem with all these things is they're very costly and they cut across all kinds of interests.
Thanks very much. Right, this is the order I saw the hands, so Sue's next.
Would you want to leave me till later?
Well, I will do then.
You leave me till a bit later.
All right, then. Becky's next then.
I was just going to come back to what Nicola was saying, and I suppose the reason why they don't do that is because we don't have an international socialist system, and therefore nationalist interests and the competition means that the working class aren't sitting down and making decisions about what's most efficient in the use of our resources on a global basis, and until we get that, we'll continue to have capitalist interests and big business and national interests determining how we use our natural resources. So we need a revolution.
Okay. I agree, thank you. Right, next and then Nick.
Interesting, there's been a sort of propaganda that's come out to actually, you know, cut out red tape, you don't need bureaucracy, you don't need planning regulations, etc., etc. And that seems to be go along with the idea of fracking, to, you know, go ahead and do it and don't bother about the risks and so on. And it does tend to, you don't want people to suffer in the terms of the fact that an unrestricted, unregulated private industry, you know, gold rush type temperament causes people to suffer. But obviously if that does happen, and obviously people are going to think, well, you do need to think collectively, you do of the common good, and the health and safety in terms of rather than these horrendous things does matter, and therefore the gold rush people are going to have to sort of go take a walk.
thanks very much, Dick. Nicola?
No, I don't want to.
This seems like the ideal time to bring in the last comment. So.
Yeah, I just wanted to come back on the thing about coal, because we've got a kind of romantic attachment to coal because of the miners' strike, I believe, which is the anniversary of this year. And I think that's quite dangerous, because the destruction of the coal industry in this country was a political act. It was deliberately, really, to get rid of the National Union of Miners. That's what it was really about.
Yeah.
And to take control away from, you know, working class people who produced energy. So I think we should stop kind of thinking coal is better because miners are nice and we would like the miners that remain, you know, the miners that are still around to continue in their jobs. I think what we have to do instead, like Martin says, you know, if there are coal reserves, whether it's economic to get them out or not, I don't think is the issue. I think the issue is the one about what damage does it do to the environment, what damage does it do to the climate. But I think what we do need to start arguing is that we are resourceful enough to be able to deal with the issues of storage, the issues of distribution, the issues of production, if we don't have to do it for a profit, if we're not all the time saying what is economically viable, what will make us a profit, what will be the cheapest thing to do, if we're instead saying what do we need, what does humanity need in the energy line, how are we going to use it, what are we going to use it for, and how are we going to actually control the way energy is produced and made and used. And I think it's that we need to be looking at, really, as socialists. And also, we're talking about, you know, it being very expensive to do research, it being very expensive to produce things different ways. Well, actually, we've got a big problem with unemployment. You know, I mean, there was a project done around looking at creating 1 million climate jobs a while ago by the Campaign for Climate Change and the trade union wing of that. And that sounds to me like an eminently sensible idea. You know, we have lots of people without jobs. We have lots of people who may be going to be offered jobs in fracking and the energy industry. Well, instead of that, why don't we look at what we need to develop and get people who, you know, haven't got jobs actually developing that, training people, taking people from the other industries that actually, you know, create lots of carbon, etc., and putting, you know, looking at how can we create those jobs. So I think that's one campaign that we really need to try to give more prominence to, really. 1 million climate jobs, not green jobs, but climate jobs, actually jobs that are linked directly to stopping climate change and to making, you know, a more sustainable way of living on this earth.
Thanks very much, Sue. I'm going to bring Anthony back in, unless anyone's got any last comments. Okay, look, right off.
Well, first of all, on the subject of coal, no, I don't think bringing back coal is the answer, because coal is, at the end of the day, a fossil fuel and does put out a lot of carbon. Having said that, though, the former mining areas needn't lose out at all, because near to every sort of former pit seems to be a slag heap, as they call them, which seemed to me would be a perfect place to put wind turbines on top of, because they're sort of like open to the elements, and also they tend to be sort of too polluted to use for an awful lot in the way of agriculture, but they sound to me like possible places where you could put solar panels, just like people have done in heavily polluted sort of fields, bought them up cheap and put solar there. Now, it's certainly true to say that the next set of wars are likely to be over not just water shortages, but food shortages, as well as a result of climate change, which is something which can only be prevented, of course, by sort of keeping climate in check and getting rid of the greenhouse gases. Now, solar power, you could import it from Spain or what have you. One project which I gather is perfectly feasible is to build a massive sort of solar generation facility in the Sahara Desert, and that if you pump seawater in, I gather you'd get out not just enough solar energy for all of Europe, but also clean water for the drought areas of Africa. Now, about storing the energy, for one thing, there is new technology regarding batteries where instead of having a separate entire battery for each sort of amount of energy stored, it has the electrolyte flows through, the electrolyte being the bit that stores the energy and could be stored in tanks, which would certainly make energy storage a hell of a lot more efficient. Another thing that could be done would be find some way to, this would entail central planning, sort of ration the energy usage to businesses so that energy intensive sort of stuff could be done at times of when the supply is at its largest. You're certainly right about Holland being having a long history of flooding and flood defences. One of the first things you notice when you take the ferry over to Rotterdam is that there's a great big seawall which can actually slide to and from to keep the sea out. I gather capable of withstanding a Atlantic type tropical hurricane, although whether that'll still be the case as the sea level rises because of global warming is another story entirely. Another thing which you notice is the vast number of windmills in Rotterdam, which are always a pleasant sight, at least to my eyes. Now, it's better to come back on the... Who is in control of fracking? Well, yes, the big energy companies. Whether it be the likes of Total who are already big in oil, or whether it be Quadrill. Now, I'm not sure whether they're big in oil or not. The fact is that it's sort of like a big business. Who's going to benefit? Is there going to be cheap gas for us? Well, the short answer is no, because as soon as the gas price falls below a certain level, they're going to stop producing anymore anyway. Indeed, in America, they've already got to the point where the gas price has reduced below a certain level and they've stopped building any more fracking plants. Not that that's a bad thing, you understand, but it means that capitalism will never give us cheap energy. It's not in capitalism's business to let us benefit. The fact is that a rational energy policy, although it's technically very feasible, very easily doable, not that difficult to implement, has so many insurmountable barriers within the capitalist structure, within a capitalist economy. Profiteering by the energy companies is only possible if they can keep selling us more energy, for example, which is at odds with energy efficiency, which is why there's not more investment in, say, home insulation or what have you. Indeed, competition, not cooperation, also leads to you get the situation of lorries passing on the motorway, one may be travelling from London to Edinburgh, the other from Edinburgh to London, carrying exactly the same goods but produced and or sold by different companies, which is such a waste in terms of the energy and such a waste in terms of carbon emissions. The importation of goods which can easily be produced locally, for example, lamb from New Zealand, where there's a surplus produced, say, in Wales. There's the production of electronic equipment which needs replacing every few years because it becomes obsolete. For example, I've got perfectly good computers from back in the 90s, but which are no longer any good because after a while the software stops being produced. Now, yes, we do need to keep pushing for reforms under capitalism. 1 million climate jobs, well, I've only got one gripe with that. Why does it have to be only 1 million? Why can't it be 2 million or 3 million to get rid of unemployment altogether? At the end of the day, though, real action to combat climate change and energy poverty means not looking to the likes of fracking or nuclear power, but it means we've got to overthrow the inherently wasteful capitalist system and replace it with a system where energy production and production in general is planned according to human need, not corporate greed.